It is good seeing you. Let me get this a bit down. Just to say again what Murray just said, I'm going to be sharing the story of Lichtpunt to some extent, but I'm not going to do that at least in a chronological way from beginning in 2010 all the way to now. Rather, what we're going to do is we're going to share a bit about lessons that we have learned in the last 8 years as a church, and intertwined with that, there will be bits of the Lichtpunt story. Hopefully, it will make sense, and it will be encouraging to all of us. As I was preparing for this and thinking in terms of preparing over those lessons that we've learned in ministry, I stumbled across a quote from Martin Luther that I thought was applicable to what I do want to share with us today. Martin Luther said that the world is like a drunken peasant. If you lift him into the saddle on one side, he will fall again off on the other side. And what Martin Luther said there, basically in a very provocative way, as he always did, is he was saying that our natural human tendency is always to veer to some or other extreme. And as we go into our extremes, often what happens is that we end up harming ourselves and also others in the process. The reality is, and we all know this, if we're deadly honest with ourselves, we all have our personal preferences. We all have our our particular personalities and even our sinful biases. And what happens is that because of those things, we do often go into our various extremes, and then we fall off of Martin Luther's proverbial horse so often. Now, Luther, of course, was known for the fact that that he countered that tendency with what the theologians and the scholars, the historians out there, coined Luther's theology of paradox. You might be aware of that. So Luther argued that as you come to Scripture, there's actually lots that the Bible has to say, and often you find that there's these seemingly contradictory truths, and what Luther was saying is, well, you don't choose the one side to the neglect of the other, but you try and live in the tension, you try and stay on the horse. And so for Luther, it was stuff like law and gospel, sinner and saint, now and not yet, Lord of all, servant of all, and many, many others. And he was saying to us, let's stay on the horse. Let's not try and resolve many of these things that the Bible say and go into one, fall off on the one side of the horse or the other. And the reason, friends, why I'm mentioning this is because as we were thinking about sharing what were the particular lessons that we've learned in ministry, we realized that this was right at the heart of what we learned in ministry, as we were busy with local church ministry, is that there's often multiple things that the Bible is saying, and because of our personalities and our sins and often our preferences, we always want to go into one or other direction instead of keeping the tension and staying on the horse. And so that's what I would like to share with you in our time together. And there's, if I had the time, there was actually six different tensions that we are trying to live in, and we have fallen off on both sides over the years. But for the sake of time, I'm going to mention four, and you can talk to me afterwards if there's if you're interested to hear a bit more about the other two that we are living in and struggling with. The first one, and it should be up on the screen behind you, is the one of the tension of being organic yet organizational. You see, when Lichtpunt was planted in 2010, we were from the outset drawn to an organic approach to ministry, by which I mean we wanted to be a church that would be highly relational, one where we would be comfortable with messiness, one where everything in the church isn't micromanaged and systematized and into processes and into programs, and where money is rather spent on people than on property. And we were passionate and zealous about that. Theologically, the reason why we wanted to do that is that we were drawn to those very typical passages that you find, and I'm sure that you also love and cherish those passages, such in Acts chapter 2 and Acts chapter 4, where we get this picture of the church being of one heart and soul, that the church had all things in common, that they were breaking bread, yes, having the Lord's Supper in their houses. No way that there was a pastor there, because they were 3,000. They didn't have, you know, you do the sums. It's impossible that they had actually a local pastor there. And then there's, of course, those classic texts such as 1 Thessalonians 2 verse 8 where Paul is saying that, listen, I did not only share the gospel with you, but of course I've shared my life with you. It's what Richard referred to yesterday when Paul says there in Acts 20, you know, because we actually had a relationship with each other. So that's theologically why we were keen on being an organic church, but then there's also strategically why we're especially keen on being organic churches. For both Tuabi and myself, we grew up in a very typical Afrikaans cultural Christian background. One where there's literally a church, and still a church that is functioning to some extent, on every single corner. Our context is one full of traditional and mega churches. And if we're honest, both ourselves, but also our friends and our families, became totally disillusioned with the church. We became totally disillusioned with the religious red tape of the traditional churches and of the smoke machines and the hype and the spin of the mega churches. And so we were dead set. We're not going to be a church like that. And so in April 2010, Lichtpunt was planted. We started off with just under 30 adults. I think there were two kids at that stage, my own and Tuabi's eldest. And we were highly relational, very organic. We constantly said to our people, we are going to be intentionally unintentional. So actually we are intentional, but it's going to look as if we're very unintentional in every single thing that we are doing. The result was that we saw actually quite a miraculous, drastic growth in the first year and a half or so. So by end of 2011, I think we were roughly 200 at that stage, and mostly in the Afrikaans cultural context, lots of de-churched people. They haven't given up on Jesus fully, but they were definitely sick and tired of the established church. However, as time went by and as our church grew, we quickly realized that only being organic is not only impossible, it's actually unbiblical. It is actually unbiblical. Theologically speaking, and there's lots that we could say in this regard, but if you look at the New Testament, there's a lot of organizational stuff that you find in the New Testament. We are told that there are offices such as elders and deacons, and we are given specific requirements for those. We are given job descriptions as such for those. We see in the New Testament that even at times, and the Congregationists would like it, I don't think you know if there's any here, but that there was even some form of voting in certain occasions. We know in their services, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 14, that there ought to be order. That is not just let's see how the Spirit leads us. There's actually order when we gather as God's people. But again, strategically, we realized that it is very easy to be organic as a church when you are 30 to 50 people. But if the church grows and you are, let's say, in the size of 150 to 300, or you are 300 to a 500 size church, and you still try and do messy church, you end up with grumpy church. That is what happens. Because your people, after a while, get discouraged and they get disillusioned with all of the mess. It's just, it's sociology. You cannot manage 500 people or 300 people the same way that you would do 10 people or 20 people. And so if you think of, I've got four kids, but two sons, the eldest and the youngest are sons. My oldest boy is 9, his name is Liam, and the youngest is Finn, and he is 5 years old. Now let's say I decide to swap their shoes. What would happen if I swapped their shoes is that they would be very unhappy and frustrated, and probably even at worst, it will do damage and it might even stunt growth. At least if I put my 9-year-old boy in the shoes of the 5-year-old. And the same, friends, is true of the church. Churches are different life stages, different sizes. And what happens is that if the clothing, if the shoes that you put on the church that is 300 or 500, but you're treating it like a church of 50 people, you're going to have lots of discouragement and disillusioned people. The opposite is also true. And I can't remember what I said. If you put the, which one did I do? If you put in the if you treat the small church like you would the big church, then it would be clumsy, and it wouldn't work. And the other way around, again, you might even stunt growth in your church. And so ways that we've tried to be more organizational as the years have gone on and as we've grown is that we have as a church become increasingly clear and vocal about who we are as a church, why we exist, and where we are going. It's the kind of stuff often you might know the lingo where you talk about your mission and your vision and your DNA. And it's very, very important not to just laugh it off. And I think Richard has said quite a bit of this over the last 2 days. Mobilizing a bigger number of people requires clear and simple and persuasive language. You're not going to get away with fuzziness. You need clarity, and so you need to think through those things. As the years have gone on, we've been forced to write more policies and papers to explain what we do and why we do what we do and how we do what we do. We've had to put in place membership. I think I said it a few years ago at one of the Generate conferences, is that we actually in the beginning were very vocal about the fact that we don't see membership in the Bible. That's nonsense. It's just all organic, and let the Spirit do what the Spirit wants to. And we had to publicly repent over that. A few years in, probably 4 years ago now, we went through a very nasty church discipline situation where we had to make it known to the church a particular unrepentant sin of someone. And that person actually wanted to take legal action against us for defamation of name. And so for that reason, a few others, we realized that we actually need membership, not only to safeguard us from that kind of thing, but actually so that we don't have to go through this kind of mess the whole time, because the congregation knows what they can expect from the elders, and they also know what the elders expect from them as a church. In essence, it's a covenant. People saying, we know why we are in this thing called the local church together. Apart from that, we had to step up and be more organizational when it comes to our communication, communicating in different ways at times and through different mediums at times. When it comes to property, in the beginning we said, we'll never spend any time any money on property, and we had to repent of that too. Because you see, the staff grew and we needed office space. We needed a bigger office space. Our kids grew and we didn't fit into the one or the two rooms, and in the winter you can't sit outside anymore any longer. So we had to get more children's spaces, new bathrooms. We had to help our congregation every single week in our church. The people have to do all the setup from scratch and break everything down because we don't own the place. And we had to work hard at making life easier for the volunteers so that we don't burn them out in a year, but actually can be in the same local congregation for the next 10, 20, 30 years. And so think of rugby. I could have used another sport, but I like rugby. In rugby, of course, there's rules. You can't just do what you want to do. There's actually boundaries. Grenze, I don't know, is it boundaries? Yeah, there's boundaries and where you can play and what you should do and when are you outside of the lines. You've got a ref. And if you ignore those things, it's not rugby. It's utterly, utterly chaos. But if you stay within those things, then you can actually enjoy the game, and then it's up for grabs. How you want to play the game, you're free to do that as long as you are doing it within those boundaries. And that is the sort of tension that we trying to sit on the horse here, saying, well, yes, there is this organizational part of being church, but also we want to be organic. The second one is this. The second tension that we have over the years increasingly realized, and we're trying to stay on the horse with this one, is contextualization, being contextual yet being confessional. Lichtpunt has from the outset been very, very serious and passionate about contextualization. Now, I'm fully aware that there might be a few of you here sitting and you're slightly skeptic about contextualization, because that is the slippery slope, according to you, that leads to liberalism. But friends, we need not reject clear biblical truths because some heretic or liberal out there is getting it wrong. If we do that, you have to give up on the Trinity. You need to give up on a bunch of other biblical things that we hold to. Now, if I had time, I would have loved to actually walk through Acts 13 to 17. I do think that there's lots that we see in Paul's way of doing ministry, both in what he said, but also in how he did his ministry, that I would argue is contextualization. There's, of course, the well-known passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, where you all know Paul saying that he has become all things to all people in order to save some. But I wanted to draw your attention to a book that I really want to encourage you to read. It's a book from Michael Horton. It's an excellent book called The Gospel Commission, where Michael Horton argues that the Great Commission itself necessitates contextualization. The very fact that Jesus says, go and make disciples of all nations, says Horton, requires sensitivity to diverse cultural contexts. Horton says, contextualization is the attempt to situate particular beliefs and practices in their cultural environment. Here's another quote. I wanted to put it up on the screen because I think it's worth for us pondering about this just for a moment before I get to the practical stuff. Horton elaborates later in the book and he says, God has revealed himself through the particular cultures, personalities, and languages of prophets and apostles across a diverse stretch of geography and history. We do not ascend away from the supposed realm of shadows to eternity in speculative contemplation of unchanging being. Rather, God has descended to us in the incarnate Word, and he still speaks to us through ordinary human speech, through water, bread, and wine. As the consummate missionary, the triune God is the master of contextualization. As Calvin remarked, God speaks baby talk, stooping far beneath his loftiness in order to communicate his saving mercies. And all of this, friends, to say that as a church, as Lichtbund, we are constantly, we did this in the beginning, and we're still doing this, we are constantly asking ourselves, how can we proclaim and display God's never-changing word in categories that will truly be understood by those who we are seeking to make disciples and mature as disciples. Now, here's the irony of all of that. The irony is that instead of our burden, our passion to contextualize, instead of leading us down the slippery slope of liberalism, what contextualization has done, i.e. engaging with culture, it has actually made us increasingly confessional over the years. You see, because we are actually trying to engage with the culture, it has forced us to be more vocal in upholding and defending the historical tenets of the faith. Inerrancy, the physical resurrection is a biggie in our context, the physical resurrection of Christ, the person and the work of the Spirit, and so on and so on. We have to be vocal and be crystal clear on the traditional views that the church has held in so many different issues over the years, things as marriage and divorce, gender, sexuality, and so on. Another thing where we've become more confessional over the years has been that we have elevated the importance of the sacraments. Maybe it's just because we're getting older, so we're getting more and more nerdy. It might be that, but we are understanding and therefore being more and more elevating the sacraments more. We almost doubled the number of times that we are celebrating the baptism and the Lord's Supper this year than we even did a year or 2 years ago. And we really work hard and we put a lot of effort and intention into making our baptisms and our Lord's Supper joyful and special occasions. We are intentional in singing the classic old hymns and psalms of the past and working them. It's not the sum total of what we're doing, but we're intentional of choosing those songs. However, and here I think many of our reformed type people often fall off of the confessional side of the horse. You see, what often happens in the reformed circles is, I think rightly we want to sing the hymns and the psalms. But what often then happens is that we sing it as if we're in Geneva somewhere in the 1500s. And we do need to understand, friends, and remember that the actual magic to those songs are in the words. It's not actually the melodies. It's not actually that. And if you want to sort of go for that, then you're making a mistake, because I promise you that the Psalms, at least, definitely didn't have the same tunes that Luther and Calvin and those guys sang. We know they had other Hebrew melodies. And the point with that is, by all means, sing the Psalms, sing the hymns, give them good doctrine in your music, but change the melody. Or if you want to keep the melody, change the rhythm or the tempo in which you sing the song, so that it can be relatable to the people in 2018 in your context. One of the other things that we have, a way in which we become more confessional, is when it comes to liturgy. Probably in the last 2 years, that's been one of the most distinct things, that we've put an extra effort into liturgy in our worship services. We've got a lady on staff with us who is a phenomenal musician. She's probably the best theologian amongst everyone on staff. And she spends a lot of time every single week being very intentional in making sure that from beginning to end in our worship gathering, that we are proclaiming the gospel story from beginning to end. And that we are hitting all of those mountain peaks that are necessary, that the Bible tells us is part of worshiping God. And so she makes sure in our worship services that we get to adoration, that there's confession, there's assurance, there's thanksgiving, petition and intercession, there's instruction, there's communion and fellowship, there's charge and there's blessing. And she's intentional about that. She spends hours every week making sure that we can work that into our worship services. Now, again, there's the danger, I think, of falling off of the confessional horse. Some people love liturgy. That's like their thing. And so what we try and do, and you might disagree with me on this, but what we try and do is, yes, we want to have liturgy, but we keep our liturgy in the back office. We don't bring it to the front window. In other words, we want the gospel narrative and all those various things to be shaping our people, but we don't give it to them in a bullet point. These are the eight stations that we are working through. Now, you might like that. Our particular conviction is that often what happens is that the kind of guys that are asking for that often is really trying to do liturgy for a different audience. And it's often the audience of Calvin and Warfield and Owen. So give them the good stuff, but do it in a way that makes sense to the typical normal person in your midst who's actually not Calvin or Owen or whoever it might be. Listen to this great quote from John Stott. It actually comes from his book on preaching. So he's talking specifically here about communication in preaching, but of course, everything that we do, everything you do to some extent, is a form of communication, even if it's your body language. Listen to what Stott says. He says, we should be praying. Is it up there? Yeah. We should be praying that God will raise up a new generation of Christian communicators who are determined to bridge the chasm, who struggle to relate God's unchanging word to our ever-changing world. Communicators who refuse to sacrifice truth to relevance, but also who refuse to sacrifice relevance to truth. So there, Stott is talking about sitting on the horse, keeping both those things, keeping the tension. Here's the third thing. The third tension that we are finding ourselves in and trying to stay on the horse is the ideas of gathered versus scattered church. Now, I'm sure that all of you have heard, it's quite popular nowadays, the words, we don't go to church, we are the church. And I don't know what you think about that. Lots of people love it. Other people find it very annoying when they hear those words. We've come to the position of saying, it's not an either or, it is a both and. So have a look with me here at a passage. It's 1 Corinthians 14, verse 19 to 23. Paul is, of course, talking about something totally different. I'm not even going to read it. You can look through it. I'm just trying to save time here. But you can have a look there with me. Paul's point there, or in the same breath at least, do you see there in verse 19, Paul refers to the church in verse 19, which is, of course, the word ecclesia. And he refers to it in verse 19 as the formal gathering of God's people. But literally a few verses later in verse 23, and please come and help me if I'm misunderstanding this verse, he seems to be talking about the church, still the word ecclesia, as the people themselves who then come together. They synergomai together. They come together. The church comes together. And so it seems to us at least that when we talk about the church, it is, yes, we go to church. Of course, not the building, but we go to the formal gathering. And that thing, that formal gathering, is church in a very, very significant, central way. But yes, we are also the church. Now, when we planted Lichtpunt 2010, we were very intentional in emphasizing the fact that we are the church, that there is a scattered reality to our existence as the church. Again, the reason being that in our context, in Pretoria, in a typical, very frustrating Afrikaans cultural Christianity, most people's understanding of church is something that you do for an hour and a half. It's basically a glorified TED talk with a few songs at the end or in the beginning. And so in order to stem that cultural tide, we worked hard at making our small groups. Now, we call our small groups Lichtpunt Gesinne. In English, it would be Lichtpunt Families. And we worked very hard in making our Lichtpunt Families the heart and the engine of who we are as a church and what we do as a church. And so our Lichtpunt Families is not less than, but it is more than merely Bible studies or support groups. We see our Lichtpunt Families as smaller expressions of the bigger church. They are groups, ideally in the same area, in the same geographical area, who seek to live out Lichtpunt's mission, vision, and values in community with each other in a way that is hopefully more personable and more practical than you can do with 400 people on a Sunday for an hour and a half. And so currently we have, I think it's 28 Lichtpunt families scattered around the city of Pretoria. And our Lichtpunt families are clustered together, in a sense, into, if I can contextualize here, into parishes. And we have an elder on the ground in each of those parishes, in a sense, overseeing a cluster of Lichtpunt families in that particular area. And the job of the staff is to support both the leaders of those groups and the elders so that we can live out who we are as a church, our mission, vision, values, in the context of our Lichtpunt gesinne, our Lichtpunt families. This is very, very important. Please hear me and please challenge me afterwards on why we're doing it this way. We seek to decentralize. We're not getting this right, but at least trying it is better than nothing. We seek to decentralize ministry at our church. And so at Lichtpunt, what we are doing and saying and the way we're functioning is that mission or evangelism is not primarily done through centralized events and gatherings, not primarily. But it is the responsibility of those Lichtpunt families to draw their friends and their families into those smaller communities and eventually into the bigger church community. When it comes to mercy ministry at Lichtpunt is not a department somewhere at head office to whom we can hand over our servant responsibilities as Christians. No, we have pushed that back to our Lichtpunt gesinne and telling them that the diaconal needs in your midst, it is the responsibility of the Lichtpunt gesinne, of the family, to look after each other. Each of our Lichtpunt families, and you might think, oh, but this will be a mess. It is a mess, and it's a glorious mess. What we do is each of our Lichtpunt families are called to choose, to pray about, plan, and choose their own external long-term place of serving within our greater community. It might be a person that somebody knows. It might be a school. It might be an orphanage, whatever it might be. They decide, it's their initiative, and we don't even know half of what's going on there. And so that is what we do there. And then when a particular need, either inside the Lichtpunt family or their external serving, becomes something that is too a heavy burden for them to carry, then they will ask the help of one of the other Lichtpunt families, or then they would ask the staff or the elders to assist them in this particular area where it seems that the Lord is blessing us as a church. Friends, even when it comes to counseling, we try and push back counseling back into the group so that the bread and butter counseling needs in our midst is happening in our Lichtpunt families. Counseling is just a subsection of discipleship. It's all it is. And we're trying to do this, the bread and butter counseling there. Of course, if it is difficult and the particular leader of that group or other people in the Lichtpunt family haven't got either the expertise or the time to look after that particular counseling need, they would refer it then to a guy on staff who is full-time there to help with counseling. And in some extreme situations, that would come to the elders to step in and to help at the bigger counseling needs. Very, very important for this to work. And we're trying this, and it doesn't. It always sounds better than it is in reality. But for this to work, a very important component is to tie your small groups to your membership. In other words, at Lichtpunt, you cannot be a member of our church if you're not in one of our Lichtpunt families. And we've lost lots of people that way. But you cannot be part of this church if you're not in a Lichtpunt family, because that is the expression of this thing that we call Lichtpunt. But again, same as before, our emphasis on the scattered aspect of church life has not diminished the importance of our Sunday gatherings. If anything, it has enhanced it, because we've realized really why the Sunday gathering is so important. You see, I think what often happens, if we're deadly, brutally honest with ourselves, when we often think of small groups, and you, whatever you might call them, if we're honest, we think church is that thing that happens on the Sunday, and in order to help the thing that happens on a Sunday, we need small groups to mobilize the thing that is on Sundays. And we at least think it's the other way around. The point is that the Sunday gathering is there. Edification and envisioning and setting the vision and giving the direction is there to infuse and mobilize life that is happening more than an hour and a half in the context of our Lichtpunt families. And so think of the language of air war and ground war. What happens in a sense on Sundays, and specifically from the pulpit, is the air war, and then the real ground war is happening in the Lichtpunt families, in those smaller groups. And that is then what you are seeking to do through your preaching, expository preaching. And what we do is that the teaching, that the preaching on Sundays is also the specific passage that we would look at in our community groups. And in that way, it's going from the center, working outwards. Mission and vision casting and the instilling of our DNA, it happens on the Sunday. It happens at Lichtpunt in that on every single year, for the first at least 2 months, the first series every single year is that we are going yet again through who are we as a church, what do we believe, where are we going, and what does it mean for all of us. And every single year we do the same and the same thing, because it is that Sunday gathering that will help us all to move in the same direction. And then throughout the year, very intentionally, the lady that I mentioned earlier who does our liturgy and our worship will make sure that on a rotating basis, all of our DNA and our vision and where we want to go is constantly being worked into our Sunday gatherings, through interviews, through stories, through testimonies, and so on. And then once a month, what we do once a month, and we only started with this year, is that any of the theological big, discussions that you have about election or whatever it might be that happens in our Lichtpunt families, once a month we get together in a thing that we call Vrae wat Pla, questions that are bothering you. And there we get people together, and then almost like a Sunday school type thing, we then help our leaders in tackling some of those difficult questions that they faced in the life of the Lichtman family. I'm running out of time. I'm probably sure I am probably out of time. There was two other categories I wanted to go to, which is mission versus maturity. And again, there you need to sit on the horse with being missional, but yet seeking maturity, and also being independent, if you do believe that a local church ought to be independent to some extent, yet being interdependent. And again, there is a tension to live in. There's one last one I want to do, probably a few more minutes. The fourth and last one, though, that I want to share with you is the one of being, is living in the tension of individual versus corporate shepherding. Individual versus corporate shepherding. Richard referred to the verse in Acts 20, verse 28, the verse that says, "Keep watch over yourselves and all the flock of which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers. Be shepherds of the church of God, which he bought with his own blood." And so Paul there, similar, of course, to Peter in 1 Peter 5, is calling the elders, the ministers, the leaders of the church to shepherd God's people, as we've heard over the last two days. Now, if I'm honest, when I started out in ministry, when I heard I need to shepherd the people, I only thought of that in terms of individual shepherding. It is really discipling. I am discipling people, and that is the sum total of what my job is as the minister of a church. Now, of course, I ought to be doing that. And if I can't do that, I need to make sure that somebody is doing that. And we try to, at an individual level, shepherd our people in a number of ways. It's probably the same ways that I'm sure you're trying to do that. We're trying to do that through one-to-ones. We're trying to do that through our Lichtman families. We're trying to do that through something that we call ID groups, intentional disciple groups, which is single sex, small groups between 3 to 5 men or women, really going through a form of catechism over a period of 2 years. And there, lots of that individual discipling is taking place. We try and shepherd the flock in that individual way through leadership development. We call it, if I translate it into English, the trenches is a thing that we do with prospective leaders to give them theology and a bit of sort of help them to become future leaders. We do that with our current leaders through leaders training. Of course, we're doing that also through counseling. Again, counseling is just a subsection of discipleship. However, as the years have gone by, and as we have grown as a church, we have become increasingly convinced as the elders and as the ministers of the church of the importance of shepherding the flock corporately. I might be wrong, and I'm sure Richard would tell me afterwards if I'm wrong, but it does seem to me that there's a distinction in Acts 20, verse 28, when he talks about keeping watch over the flock and being shepherds of the church of God. And at least seems to me that being shepherds of the church of God is looking at the church in a more of a holistic sense. And we believe that is important. If you think about a doctor, when somebody comes to the doctor, it's a GP, and the doctor will do a checkup, and then afterwards would prescribe certain medicine or say, listen, you need to do exercise or diet, or whatever it might be. And the same is true of elders. Your job as the elders and the ministers is not merely to think of every single individual and say, how can you as an individual become more like Jesus? But the role and the job of the elders is to look at the church as a whole. The Bible says that the church is a body. And look at his body as the whole and asking the questions is, where are we not currently like Jesus? What is the areas in which we need to grow? And the responsibility is there to collectively help this church to become more like Jesus. What does this look like in practice? Well, it starts with the elders. So what we do at Lichtpunt is that a very, very important part of everything that we do at Lichtpunt happens in our elder planning. Our elder planning happens in the end of every year. So last year it was roughly September, October, where we're planning for the coming year. What we do as elders when we plan together there is, firstly, we remind ourselves of Lichtpunt's calling, our mission, our vision. So at Lichtpunt, what we say is we say that Lichtpunt exists to glorify God by being disciples who make disciples and by being a church who plant churches. So that is our mission and vision, if you're into that kind of language. So what that does and why the elders clarify that is remembering your mission and your vision, it tells you where you want to be as a church. So if you put it on a piece of white paper, it tells you where you want to be as a church. Then what we do in our elder meetings, we started with this last year and it's really worked well for us, is we do a SWOT analysis, a good old SWOT analysis. We consider the church and we ask, what are our strengths as a church? What are our weaknesses? What are our opportunities? And what are currently our threats? The reason why we do that is because what a SWOT analysis does for you, it tells you where you actually are. So it's one thing to know where you want to be, but it's another thing to know where you actually are. And then what we do as elders, as we plan, is we then work on strategies, specific strategies for the next year to come. It might be longer term strategies, but specifically for the year to come. And we ask ourselves, what are the particular strategies, those things that we need to do that will get us from where we are to where we want to be? These strategies then become, in a sense, the goalposts for the coming year. And so every second week, our elders come together for an elder meeting, and the categories on whatever we're discussing at the elder meetings, it's the categories that were decided at the planning meeting the year before, are the particular things that we are going to focus on in the year to come. So in a sense, our two-weekly elder meeting is a strategic meeting at 10,000 feet where we're not getting bogged down into the semantics. There's other places to that. And we are making sure that we are getting from where we are to where we want to be as a church. Then every other week, we have an exec elder meeting. Now, what we mean by exec elder meeting is that on our elder team, we've got five elders. Two of them are lay elders, and currently three of our elders are on staff as well. And so these staff elders come together the other week. And when we come together, that meeting is not at 10,000 foot, that is at 5,000 foot. And what we then are doing is we're thinking, how can we take the discussion that took place in the bigger elder meeting, and how could we make sure that is going to materialize in our congregation? That then filters down to every single week's staff meeting. And the staff meeting is the ground level, where our staff is trying to say, okay, how can we support the congregation in the realization of these strategies so that we as a church can get from where we are currently to where we want to be. The job of the teaching elders, of course, then, is to mobilize the congregation and to move them from where we are to where we want to be. This happens primarily, of course, through preaching. As I said earlier, it does not only happen through the beginning of the year preaching, where we setting and reminding everyone of where we want to go and how we're going to get there. But it happens for you as the teaching pastor in deciding what are the books that we're going to do, what are the particular themes, if you do a few thematic things throughout the year, what are the particular drums that you're going to be beating, and even right to the granular of the detail in application, constantly remembering we are busy shepherding a people into the likeness of Christ, not only individuals. It also happens then through other strategic gatherings. It happens once a quarter. We've got a thing that we do at our church. We call it, in Afrikaans, familievergadering, which is a family meeting. And once every quarter, only the members, if you're not a member of the church, the door's closed for you, you're not welcome at that meeting. Only the members have a meeting once a quarter, and a large part of what we do once a quarter there is keep getting them to move in the direction that we want to go as a church. Annually, we do that through the beginning of the year camp that we have. There we want to try and cast vision and call people to how we're going to do that. In the end of the year, we've got a celebration service where we're trying to connect all the dots and show them how the Lord has taken us on this road becoming more the church that we have set out to be in the beginning. Friends, I want to finish there. I want to just finish by saying this. Don't be selective. We all have our particular bugbears. You've got those things that excite you, those particular things in your particular camp that the Euros that you're listening to are saying. And so often what we do is we're just listening to them, and that's wonderful, but there's often actually more that is said in the world outside our particular tribe. And so it is good. We all should be part of some or other tribe, but don't be tribal. Don't be tribal. Pursue, as Richard said yesterday, pursue the whole counsel of God. And if you do, you will often find things that will seemingly be contradictions. They are not. Live in the tension. Listen to Luther. I think he was right on that. Don't fall off of the horse.